unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living.
Force of life.
The old age uprising. We need old people. Now there's a new role for old people, and they're intensely important for society because they have the time and the experience. So this, I think, is a new kind of agenda, and it's very much about the fact that the environment is in a bad shape, that we have climate problems, that we have a loss of biodiversity, we have a loss of knowledge and skills in living, we have a loss of awe in experiencing nature, we have a loss of, you know, the simple observation that life is worth living.
So I have a little standing order in the White House. Never use the word coal, only use the words clean, beautiful coal. Sounds much better, doesn't it?
We live in this world now full of noise and aggression and polarized politics, pollution and destruction. But who says it has to be that way? What if kindness and trust and honesty suddenly began getting more interest in our communities and more votes in our elections? What if we actually had a movement like a reckoning, a revolution of values? The good news is that movement is already here. It just doesn't have a name yet. But it's got one keyword, and that's life. Protecting life and making life worth living.
Force of Life.
So welcome to the Force of Life podcast series. My name is Mick, and I'm someone who's been on the lookout, you could say, searching high and low for how we solve the climate crisis for quite some time.
You seek the Holy Grail.
That is our quest. Our quest is to find the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Yes,
it is.
And so we're looking for it.
Yes, sure.
We have been for some time.
Ages.
In a series of 10 climate revolution interviews, I've been talking with people with good ideas from Australia and from around the world about how we create change, how we find that climate grail that's going to change everything, how we get organized so that our governments will actually begin to work for us, the people, and not just for industry and where the money is. And in the 10th episode of this Climate Revolution series, I talked with the British sustainability strategist, Joseph Gelfer, who suggested that we scrap the way that we are doing things and actually build a new model.
Historically unprecedented change, that is what is required. And the phrase I like to use is, you know, in service to life on Earth. If you're not in service to life on Earth, you don't deserve to be in business.
He was thinking, I think, quite far out of the box. We need to stop even talking about climate, he said. We need to start talking about politics that are rooted in service to life on Earth. So today it's a real pleasure now to be opening a new season, you could call it, of revolutionary series, no longer under the climate umbrella, but that service to life banner that Joseph Gelfer introduced to us in the 10th episode of the Climate Revolution.
Force of Life.
We're enrolling now in the Australian Force of Life. And that means for myself that I'll be putting down my hat as a climate activist. And I will not any longer be available as a volunteer in the climate action movement. Instead, I want to focus all my energy on the change at the service to life level, on the building of a new model in service to life on Earth.
Unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living.
Build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
Every country will be affected, and no one can opt out.
It should be a gentle, kind, and trustworthy model. So, for inspiration, I looked to my home country, Denmark. I actually went on a bit of a mission there recently, jumping on board a small ferry that only takes passengers and bicycles, and then, hey, chula hopsasa, I was on my bicycle there, riding over the energy-independent island of Samsø, looking at the wind turbines, and then I got the privilege of meeting the Danish author Thor Nørretranders. Thor Nørretranders, for more than four decades, he's been one of, I think, Denmark's most original voices on science and culture and our place as human beings in this big universe. He's an excellent writer, but he's also someone worth listening to, as you will hear in the podcast episode here today. Thor has got some ideas about how we can reinvent the world, and he's got some experiences as well about how societies can find new ways of living together in times of crisis.
I have seen the Grail!
Nobody here.
I have seen it! I have seen it! But there is one small problem.
And according to Thor, an important element in this change, in this new model, could be an elders revolution.
My name is Thor. I'm a 70-year-old writer. I've been writing about science, environment, energy, society, and stuff like that for most of my life. I have an education in environmental planning, originally academic, but I've mostly been working in the media and producing books outside the media world for many, many years. And it's, I don't know, it's 40-plus books or something. And my main interest has been, what is it like to be a human being? How much of what you experience as a human being can you share with other human beings? And what should you share with other human beings? And how do we open our eyes to nature and the world and the universe? I'm an old amateur astronomer. I'm very interested in the stars. How do we open up and actually acknowledge the fact that we are living in this fantastic universe and this fantastic planet, and that we also live in a society that has a lot of nice features and a lot of warmth between human beings, but also is suffering from all these mechanisms that take over the economy and the way societies run. And so you can say my life has been one long walk of trying to understand what we can and should do as human beings to make sure that life will go on, that the show will go on. The phenomenon of life is all about giving to the world a copy of yourself via sexual reproduction combined with a copy of someone else. But life is all about the ability to pass on that ability to live to someone else, to kids, and in a wider context, to pass on a way of managing the environment or living in the environment that will make certain that people and animals and flowers and plants can go on living there. So that's what I've been trying to do. And then now, as I turn 70, I start thinking, okay, I'm an old guy now. I was very much a child of the youth revolt, of the counterculture of the 60s and 70s. But now I'm an old chap, and how would that fit into that picture? Because it's obviously not a student revolt or anything like that anymore. So my latest book, which I published at my 70th birthday, is about the role of the old guys, the old women and the old people in society. And much to my own surprise, it turns out that they, in my view, have a key role in how we should go about creating a better future. There are two major reasons for that. One is that there's a phenomenon discovered in the 70s in the science of fishing by French-Canadian fishing scientist Daniel Pauly, who made a simple observation which he called the shifting baseline syndrome, that every time a new generation of fishery scientists come about, they believe that the number of fish in the ocean that's there when they arrived as professionals is the true number of fish in the oceans. And so they create a baseline, which is, this is what there is. And this is the baseline, and we see if fish disappear compared to that baseline. But he can show from the literature that the actual number of fish is falling all the time. So the shifting baseline is that you tend to believe that what was there when you came is the natural number, so to speak. So that the big changes you will never discover, because you assume that the world as you came to know it is the real world, so to speak. And this simple idea of shifting baseline syndrome has now spread to a lot of sciences, far away from fishery, because it turns out to be the case in almost all walks of life that people tend to forget that the world that they learned about when they were young is not the actual world, but the world as it was at that time. And maybe there's a lot of, for instance, in society, there's a lot of hanging together forces, a lot of attracting forces that brought people together that have now disappeared. Nobody can remember, because everyone growing up these days never knew about this. There was a lot of phenomena in nature that we were familiar with a few hundred years ago, and any peasant would know the name of all these wild plants you could eat, for instance. They're forgotten now. And you can even show the studies in Africa showing that for each generation, there's a big chunk of knowledge of the wild edibility of the wild plants that disappears. So it seems that we adjust our idea of how the world could be from observing how the world is when we start looking at it. And so we change the baseline so that we never understand that there was something that was in old times, there was something that was more rich. There was a bigger variety, a bigger diversity of plants, of human relations, of features in society and so on. We tend to forget that. And I think old people, people with experience, are very important now, because they can remember that there used to be snow on the roads in Denmark. We don't have much snow anymore. When I was a kid, many, many, many years ago, it was every year there was snow in the roads. We used to have a lot of edible stuff in our gardens. We don't have that anymore. We used to have a lot of stuff that and ways of going about other people in society that have disappeared. And old people are very important, because they can say, there are other ways than what we do now. For instance, everybody is now consumed by the screens on their smartphones or their television screen or their computer screen. And does anyone remember the fact that you could read a book and it was not noisy and didn't necessitate that you charge your battery all the time? I mean, the old people know things that are very useful. Also, of course, old people, there are things old people don't know, and that younger people are better at. But the simple observation that old people have a knowledge that is very valuable to society, and in particular to the environment, is I think very heartening. And I grew up in a culture that would say old people have no use, basically. They're just stupid. We don't need them. They have all this wisdom crap that you heard about in primitive cultures is not relevant, is not interesting. So old people are just, I mean, we should support them and give them something to eat and nurse them and all that. But basically, they're of no use. And this, I think, has to change radically, because there is a use for experience. The other thing that's very important is to, if you look at the life of someone from a country like Denmark or Australia these days, you could say life is split up in three parts. The first 20 years, the middle 50 years, and the last 20 years. The first 20 years is about being a child and a youngster. And that's where we usually assume all the change will come from, and all the novelties will come from, and all the trouble will come from, and all the noise will come from. And then you have 50 years of production and reproduction. You take a job, you raise your kids, you do your stuff, you are a grown up in society and all that. But nowadays, the story doesn't end there after 20 plus 50 years. because the prognosis for someone like me being 70 is that statistically I will survive 20 years. Of course, the mean age, living age, lifespan in Denmark is not 90 years, but it's 80 years. So you could say I would only have 10 years left. Yes, but that's when you include all the people who die as kids or as youngsters. For anyone who's actually reached the age of 70, the prognosis is 20 more years to go. And that's a long time. It's as long time I used as being a kid and as a youngster. And boy, did I learn a lot during those first 20 years. Did I do a lot? Did I make a lot of mistakes? Did I have a lot of fun? Did I change stuff? Did I call for new agendas? Did I make noise and problems for institutions? Yes, I did. I was kicked out of school. I was creating an astronomy club and an astronomical union in Scandinavia. I was doing politics. I was doing all kind of weird stuff in those first 20 years. And why shouldn't I be doing that in the last 20 years? Because now, like anyone at this age, I have a lot of time, I have a lot of experience, and I have a lot of feeling of something going wrong. I have this feeling that this is not good, there's something wrong here. I don't want to leave this planet in a messy state, if I can in any way work against that. I want to be proud of myself and the environment that I leave behind. So that's why I wrote this book, calling for an old age revolt, if you like. In Denmark, we call it Ungdomsoprør, the revolt of the young people, what happened in the 60s and 70s. So now it should be the old age revolt or the old age uprising. Another way of saying it is the good old people. We need good old people also in these times of artificial intelligence and all that. We need old people. And that to me is news in the sense that I didn't think that way 20 or 30 years ago. That now there's a new role for old people, and they're intensely important for society because they have the time and the experience. So this, I think, is a new kind of agenda. And it's very much about the fact that the environment is in a bad shape, that we have climate problems, that we have a loss of biodiversity, we have a loss of knowledge and skills in living, we have a loss of awe in experiencing nature, we have a loss of, you know, the simple observation that life is worth living. And I think that's very important. And I think we can learn a lot from very old people. I've learned a lot from friends who were very close to dying. Some of them actually died. Some of them survived the verdict of the medical doctors. But there's a surprising fact which I think has been well known for many, many years, but it's not spoken very much about, that people who are very close to death suddenly get the ability to see the world as a beautiful and fantastic and very, very rich thing. And they suddenly start enjoying the color of a flower or the extent of the sky or a gentle act by another human being. They suddenly appreciate that in a new way. And you can put this in many ways, but you can say, when you are younger and death is an abstraction far away, you tend to ask yourself, what kind of movie is that I'm part of? Is this a good movie or a bad movie? Is something happening in this movie or not? And so you evaluate and judge the movie you feel part of. When you're very close to death, you don't really worry about, is this a good movie or a bad movie? You worry about, is this a movie or is not this not a movie? And so you take another approach. You suddenly take what is there as what it is, instead of judging and comparing, or could I have been a professional football player, or could I have been an opera singer, or could I have had blah, 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 blah. All of this crap that we tend to think, and especially people over 60 tend to think about their life in terms of, but if I had chosen that profession or that woman or that country or that something, I would have had a much more interesting life. And that's a big danger, that people start thinking in parallel universes, or if only I had done this or that, then everything would be nice and so on. And it turns out, of course, that this is silly, because if you think about it in terms of life partners, on a depressed afternoon, you can think, oh, if only I had chosen her or her or her, and then you come up with 17 interesting women you could have chosen. If you have chosen one of them, you would be very happy. Each of them, you would be very happy. But then you can end your little meditation of depression by asking yourself, yes, but I couldn't have had all of them anyway. No way I could have gone through 17 marriages or 17 jobs or 17 countries. So you have to choose. And you have to accept that I've chosen this. I'm no longer young enough to start again. So I have to accept myself and the world as it is, and see what problems should I address, what should I do something about, and look how beautiful it is. And I think you can learn that from people who are very close to death. And one of the things I've been interested in is, are there techniques that we could use to bring this very strong kind of state of presence that you find amongst people close to death or believing themselves to be close to death, can we take that and sort of roll it backwards into life? So you don't have to be close to death to get this immediate observation of the beauty of the world. And I think that's in many ways a key to how to make people more aware of stuff like environmental problems, biodiversity, climate and stuff, is to help us understand the beauty and also the problem of the world in this very direct sense. And I've no simple answer, but there's no question that many techniques used in many cultures like meditation will help you observe the world as it is, that going, spending more time in nature will help you understand stuff like this. Walking more, I have a daily 1 hour walk that I do, and to many people's surprise, along the same route in the landscape. And people say, that's weird, why don't you take another route every day? No, because I want to see the seasons and the daily weather change. The more you do stuff like that, the closer you get to some kind of awareness of, wow, this is just fantastic. So I think awe and the feeling of wow and the feeling of whoa is what we need to share. And that is really appreciating life and stuff. And I think old people have a lot to teach younger people about that just sit down and observe and take it in and enjoy. The English word awe is very important here. And there's a number of psychologists starting over the past few decades to study this phenomenon of this awe feeling of meeting something in nature or society that fills you with this sense of it's very big, it's very fantastic, and it forces you to change your view of many things. And that can be a tree, or it can be a sunset, or it can be an act of generosity you see amongst human beings. It can be many different things, but it will just give you this feeling of whoa. And also your hair, you will have your hairs raising on your skin and so on. Goosebumps. And I think that is very important, because it's something we all want and we all feel very strongly when we have it. Not very often, but you can seek it. And it turns out that the more you The more you feel awe, the more you want to protect that which fills you with awe, like nature. So it's almost a snowball effect that nature will fill you with awe. Awe will want you to protect nature, which then will persist and therefore fill you with more awe. So the more you feel this awe thing, the more you want to protect what feeds it, and so it becomes like a snowball. And I think that's a very important thing, that everybody should experience the beauty of life. And I'm not sure you find that on a screen, on a smartphone. You find directions to it. I use smartphones and computers a lot, and it helps me find the places that will fill me with awe, but not necessarily itself do it. And I think we need to find more of that, and we need to have this feeling of resonance, as Hartmut Rosa, a German sociologist, calls it, this feeling of resonance with the environment, where we can sense that, ooh, I'm vibrating together with the world. I think that's very important. Of course, you have to then to do something, and to do something together with other human beings. But I'm just saying, we should be very interested in what will make us feel at home in the world. And then, of course, we should be eager to protect the world that we feel at home with. And the reason I believe that the right thing to do is to start locally is that you don't have to ask anyone. You don't have to look at what other people do. You can just say, oh, how about us in our little community here trying to be more self-sufficient? So it's not something that you have to wait for other people to allow you to do. And if we go on the level of philosophy, of ethics and stuff like that, there's a very famous philosopher, the most famous of modern philosophers, perhaps, Immanuel Kant, a German guy from the 1700s, who came up with this very simple idea, which unfortunately has a very silly name, the categorical imperative, that which everybody thinks, oh, that's not for me, and that's very German and impossible to understand. But the idea is extremely simple. The idea that Kant has is that whenever you want to do something, ask yourself, would I be happy if other people in the same situation as I am in was doing the same thing? And then if you feel, no, I wouldn't be happy if other people did what I'm about to do, then you shouldn't do it. If you feel, I would be happy if other people did this, then you should do it. And you could say, what's the point in that? The point is that you don't direct what other people should do. You only say, I want to act in such a way that I would like other people to act in the same way. If they were in the same situation, I would be happy if they did so, but I'm not trying to direct them to do so. And the point in this is that you see yourself as someone who represents the good way of doing stuff. Now, why would I not be happy if other people was doing what I was about to do? For instance, if I was lying, I wouldn't be happy if everybody was lying, because that would mean that nobody would believe each other, so I couldn't lie either. So it sort of falsifies itself, the idea of lying. Kant uses this example himself. Another modern example would be if everybody was flying all the time to Southeast Asia for a vacation, we know that the climate would change in such a way that Southeast Asia would be not a very pleasant place to be on a vacation. So in a sense, you can ask yourself, if I want to go on this trip with an airline a long way just to have a week of holiday, would I be happy if everybody did that? No, I would not be happy, because then the climate would change and it wouldn't be pleasant to be there. So maybe I shouldn't do it either. So it's a way of not of directing what other people should do, but just of seeing yourself as someone who does things that you would like also other people to do if they wanted to. And that is another way of seeing the whole problem with the environment and the climate and everything, that is very simple in the sense that you should be proud of your own life. You should be proud of what you're doing. You shouldn't be ashamed. You shouldn't try to hide what you're doing, because honestly, you would like other people not to know and not to do what you are doing. but that you are doing things that you believe in and that you that you're proud of. And I think it's very important. And now, since I'm interested in the elder people, it's very important that we do stuff that we are proud of, that we're not ashamed of. We don't try to hide stuff. And I think much of modern life is actually something that people want to hide. They want to be private about it. They don't want to share it with other people. And that's not a good recipe for a good life. And it wasn't the way it used to be. Just a few hundred years ago, you couldn't really hide from other people. So I think be brave and be proud and be happy and choose what you're doing as something that you want to choose. It's you're proud of your life. And the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, mostly known for all of this stuff with angst and dread and fear and trembling and all that, he says that the old age is where you realize the dreams of your youth. That's where you do the things you had always hoped you could do. And now there's the time, there's the experience, there's the freedom to do what you hope to do as a young person. And now we should all do it. And I'm sure the young people will come up with new dreams and new hopes, and they will realize that.
Unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living.
There is a way to calm the noise and realize we have a choice. As waters rise and forests burn, when we're rooted, we stand firm. We got the key to start again. Learn to live as Earth's own kin. Every breath is a gift we share. Every touch is a vow of care. It's a life full of wonder. It's a life. It takes courage, courage and strength. It's a life with purpose. Love. Life is a force. And you're invited to join.
The force of life. The old carry memory of what has been lost. The young carry dreams of what could be. Together they form a circle of guidance.
Elders hold the memory, youth the dreams and energy. Together weaving threads of time, equal, inclusive and kind. From the soil, from the commons, from the stories, from the heart. A reckoning against greed and corruption. A gentle revolt in service to life. It's a life full of wonder. It takes courage, courage and strength. Strength. It's life. Purpose and love. Life is a force. And you're invited to join.
Historically unprecedented change. That is what is required. If you're not in service to life on Earth, you don't deserve to be in business.
The new world doesn't need to be complete. It will still make the old model obsolete. It's a life full of wonder, wonder at all. It's a life, it takes courage, courage, courage. It's a life with purpose, purpose and love.
It is always because of one person that all the changes that matter in the world come about. So be that one person.
The force of life. For all the things that make life worth living.
The first thing we have to deal with now that there is this atmosphere of crisis, that we have the environmental problems, we have the loss of diversity, loss of climate stability, we have the loss of the sense of security that we've had at least for 2 or 3 decades in terms of military situations and so on. A lot of things have been changing, and I think the year of 2025 has been a year of loss of a lot of innocence. That suddenly we realize that war isn't that far away. That even if people were saying like 10 years ago that they doubted that there was a real climate effect, I mean, it's so obvious now, not only that it's there, but also that it's very unpleasant and ruins many aspects of our lives and so on. So there's this very deep sense that we really have to do something. And I think we can wait for then declarations in the United Nations, and we can wait for the top leaders of the world to meet and all that. And we've basically been waiting for that for a very long time. Another thing we can do is more like, say, how does water start boiling? It's not that water boils all over at the same time and all becomes steam at the same time. It's more like water gets hot and you have bubbles of steam and they expand and they go to the surface of the water and it starts bubbling and it's boiling. It's a local effect generated by a global change in temperature that will eventually lead to all the water becoming steam. Now, I think the way societies will change is more that we will have local bubbles of self-sustainability, of self-dependence, and that they will grow because people understand I have an ethical problem with being part of this shitty world development and the direction the world is taking. But also I have a very, very simple and very, very basic protection of myself and my family and my kids and my village on the agenda, which is all about maybe suddenly there's no more food to come with the ferry to our island of Samsu. Maybe there's no more water easily available. Maybe electricity will stop for a while and stuff like that. Maybe all this going to the theater in the larger cities will be not possible for a period of time and so on. So maybe we will have to be able to go about our lives based more on local resources than we used to. We've been through decades of globalization and this idea that everything should be produced on another continent and that not a simple shoe could be produced without 5 different continents contributing to the shoe. We've been used to all this globalization, industrialization, which we are realizing now makes us extremely vulnerable because nobody knows how to repair a shoe. 100 years ago, everybody who could make a shoe could also repair a shoe. Nowadays, nobody can make a shoe on their own and nobody can repair a shoe on their own. So it's difficult for us to do anything on our own anymore. And that makes us very, very vulnerable because if these big ocean ships cannot come with the soles for the shoes and from one continent and the laces from another continent, nobody can make a shoe anymore. So we have to think more in terms of self-sustainability and self-sufficiency so that we can create bubbles that will allow for people to live even in a world of crisis, and that slowly these bubbles will expand and cover the whole planet. I think that's more efficient than if we wait for some political agenda being made. Then, of course, these small bubbles will have to fight with the people in power who wants to have this division of labor and division of production. But then we have to take that fight. If you look at agriculture today, the global agricultural situation, it's very close to collapsing. And we have to go back to the old virtues of being able to produce on one farm basically everything.
Is there something we can learn from the Danish history, like from the cooperative movement, for instance, which has really become so embedded in Danish culture?
Danish culture is very influenced by a guy living in the 1800s called Grundtvig, Niels Frederik Severin Grundtvig. He was a priest and he was a politician and he was a poet, but mostly he was the voice of the Enlightenment change there was amongst Danish peasants in the late 1800s. And that change came about due to a crisis, and maybe most changes in the world come about due to crisis. That's what the word crisis actually means in Greek, something that changes. Now, there was a crisis because the prices were dropping drastically on corn, on grains, on wheat and rye and whatever. Mostly because huge areas in what is now Eastern Europe and Russia were suddenly contributing to the world market, and so the prices fell. And Danish peasants couldn't get the money they wanted for their produce, and so they discovered they had to change more to animals, pigs and cows and whatever. Nowadays we are more skeptical about animals than there was a reason to be at that time, because that was in the old agricultural style where the animals were actually integrated into the small farm, and a small farm would have a cow and a few horses and a few pigs and a lot of hens and chicken and whatever, and it was ecologically sound. There was a closed loop there of matter going around. Very different from modern agriculture. But at that time, there was two things missing for the farmers to change their style. One was knowledge, and the other was machinery. And what they did together in something called Andelsbevægelsen, which is owning it together movement. The owning it together movement, Andelsbevægelsen, came up with two strategic features. One was the Forsamlingshus, which was the place where people would meet and discuss stuff, sing songs, many of them written by this guy Grundtvig, discuss how to understand the universe, and sort of the average peasant was lifted in his knowledge of the world, because he needed to change his way of being a peasant. And the other thing was the Maskinstation, which was the machine station, the place where you could borrow these modern machines you needed to do agriculture. People could share them. They didn't need them all the time. And so they could go to this Maskinstation and get what they wanted for a short period. So peasants had to collaborate to change, and they had to educate to change. And this movement was very influential in Denmark. It created the højskolebevægelse, the high school, or the sort of adult high school movement, and it created a wonderful culture of poetry and songs and literature that was all about what is the meaning of life, what is the meaning of being a peasant, and so on. And that was a very beautiful thing. And one of the things that it really helped was governing the commons. There was a tradition amongst Danish peasants that there would be a common outside the village, a grass field that everybody would use and could put their cattle or whatever on to grass. And nobody would own it. Everybody would share it. It would be governed together. There was this common role of governing the commons, as it has been expressed many years later. And the point was that you had to share this and you had to learn how to live together with it. And so this idea of sharing commons was essential many years later, when this island where we're sitting now, the island of Samsø in Denmark, became pretty well known all around the world, because it was the first island in the world that decided to be self-sufficient with renewable energy. basically windmills and also a little biomass energy production. And Samsø have these windmills, and they have an enormous amount of visitors from all over the world who come and look at the windmills and say, very nice windmills, but we basically have windmills ourselves. What is so special about this? And Søren Hermansen, who is director of Samsø Energy Academy, the energy academy here, he had this problem that he had difficulty explaining foreigners what it meant that they did it together. Samsø created these windmills by sharing them, very often by andele, that is owning it together. And that was a different story from the windmills you see many other places, where people are unhappy that there are windmills in their neighborhood because they look big, and they in old days they also were noisy and so on. But on this island, the population was very happy with the windmills, basically because they were part of it. They partly owned the windmills, or at least some of them. And so Søren Hermansen came to me and said, how can we tell this story about doing it together? And this is long before I lived on Samsø. I've lived here now for 7 years, but that partly comes from this process of trying to explain to an international audience what is this sharing the windmills all about. And so we wrote a book about doing it together. It does exist in English. It's called Commonities. It's available on Kindle. And Commonities is a book saying sharing the common resources, like the wind energy, is what make communities interesting. Because there's a lot of, even at that time when we wrote the book 15 years ago, there was already a lot of interest in communities. Nowadays, there's a huge interest in communities. And the problem is that I see this interest as very often very romantic. People think, oh, if we just a community and we do things together, everybody will be happy. But the problem is that there's a lot of friction, a lot of trouble in doing things together. And you get annoyed by these other people who are involved in this project. And you get more and more annoyed every Thursday when you have this meeting, and they still complain about the same silly little detail. And so there's this problem that people lose interest in doing things together because it's actually not as nice as you would have thought when you just think of, whoa, community, everybody wants to be part of community. There's someone who once made the observation that in of all the words used in social science, like state and market and union and whatever, there's only one word, community, that is always used in a positive sense, but never in the same way. So it's sort of everybody likes community, nobody knows what it is, and most people don't like it when they experience it for more than a few weeks. So our argument was communities are like children. It's the best thing in the world, and nothing can make you more happy than dealing with children. But it's also the worst thing in the world, and nothing can make you more unhappy and impatient than children. And same stuff with communities. Now, why can you love your children? Because it's a biological necessity. There's no question about it. Why can you love a community of grown-ups that annoy each other? Because you have a mission together. And what could that mission be? That could be to govern a commons. That is to share a big resource that nobody owns, but can only be utilized if you do it together. Like the wind energy at Samsø, you had to build these windmills, you had to run them, you had to create a network of electricity and stuff. You have to do all this, and for that you need other people. And you need to accept the fact that other people differ from yourself, have their own opinions about the world, which is a very annoying feature of other people, and they make their own plans. Very annoying. But you have to share with them because you have something important to do. And so the idea is, with this community concept, that if a community wants to be well functioning, it should have some kind of common that it is dealing with. And sharing, everybody in the community is sharing this commons. And that can be, of course, the wind, but it could also be land, it could also be the ocean and the fish in the ocean. or it could be the language we speak together. Nobody owns that, but everybody contributes. It could be the culture. It could be many things. It could be outer space that are things we share in common. Nobody owns it, but you can only really use it if you use it together with other people. And so the recipe we come up with by observation, it's not a thought, it's more like an observation, is that what communities need is something to share. If you share something, it's meaningful to be in a community. If you don't share anything, it's just a pestilence. And you must accept the fact that other people are other people. They are different, and they have different ideas and plans and values than yourself, which is annoying. And like I say to my wife, the big problem with you is that you are another person with your own ideas and your own value judgments and stuff like that. I find that very annoying that you are another person. And she looks at me and she says, okay, how about yourself then? and of course, I'm another person too. So I think to take out the romantic part of the community and say, we have to start saying other people are very annoying and very beautiful, just like kids.
This is your life. Live it by your truth.
Choose life. Conquer your mind. You can do it.
Force of life.
Unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living.
This is as dark a moment as there's ever been in our democracy, and our planet is overheating fast.
They don't know what they're playing with.
Fire.
Sorry?
They're playing with fire. Drill, baby, drill.
10 years of inaction and climate culture wars had left Australia exposed to the effects of climate change.
I live with that truth. Your rental will start to close with an hour.
We're beginning to face the facts. The world is on fire. Or rather, some parts are burning, while other parts are being flooded or they're melting. And food prices are rising. Some people can't even afford to eat. So hundreds of thousands of people are in the streets protesting and so on. Some of us, I for one, begin to feel like we're being taken back to the 1930s.
The misery of our people is horrible to behold. Millions are unemployed and starving.
Hitler explains that the task ahead is massive.
Germany is suffering from the most severe crisis in the standard of living it has experienced in the entire history of the country. There are hundreds of thousands of people homeless.
All the signs are there. We're seeing the aggression build and the slide towards fascism and authoritarian leaders. And that's when I'm reminded once again about the old quote from the American architect and inventor Richard Buckminster Fuller, who talked about how we change things. He said,
You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
But if we are serious about creating change, which we certainly are, then don't we also need like some kind of revolution in politics as well? Like revolutionary politics rooted in service to life on Earth, as Joseph Gelfer said.
One thing that I noted in what he was talking about was that he insisted on saying that there was good stuff in Donald Trump and Putin and whatever people that are nowadays seen as very bad guys. And indeed, they are bad guys, but they're also interesting bad guys, because they're bad guys in a new way, or in a way that we haven't seen for like half a century. And that is that they are reintroducing politics. They have very weird and bad political ideas, but they have political ideas. And what we've seen in the past half century or more is that politics sort of collapsed into some kind of advanced form of administration. That it was all about sort of what is the economical consequence of this or that act, or how can we, in a more rational way, run the state institutions and so on? How can the state help private enterprise make more money? How can we deal with the immigration problem so that we get the immigrants we need when we need them, but not when we don't need them, and all this weird stuff, which is basically administration, which is not politics. And in a sense, with all these stupid ideas, Donald Trump reintroduces the simple thing that a politician is a guy with some ideas that he wants to use to change society. Now, of course, it's the wrong ideas and it's the bad ideas that, and so on, but it is the old style politician coming back with a vision and a direction for things to go. And you can say that's very dangerous, but you could also say, yes, but it's also opening up new possibilities. And it's a little bit like the 30s, 1930s, 100 years ago, where you had fascism, which on the one hand sort of made politics very real and very close to people and addressed their inner emotional and even sexual needs in a way that politics hadn't done for a long time. But on the other hand, it also crippled politics and society into something that was very, very unpleasant. So with fascism, for instance, you get you energize the political discussion in society in a very, very dangerous way. And the question is, can you get energy into the political discussion without the risk of the wrong outcome, like fascism or Trump or Putin? And I think the answer is no, you cannot get that. You have to accept that we are now in such a huge transformation of society, in a direction that I'm sure will end with a green revolution, with a new way of producing stuff, with everything being reinvented, societal structures, technological structures, our way of using the environment, everything will be reinvented. And now there's this struggle, is it should we be greener or less green? And we have to go through that struggle and that unpleasant discussion to get to where we want to go, that is reinventing the world. And so in a sense, one of my friends said that a guy like Donald Trump is raising all the right questions but giving all the wrong answers. And I think that is the essence of it being political. And I think that's good in a way, but of course we have to then fight to get the right answers. Remember what it was like a decade or two ago, that there was consensus amongst everybody about this is the rational thing to do and this is not the rational thing to do. Politics wasn't there, and it felt very secure and very sort of we were all very well educated and sophisticated, and had it been United States, we would say Boston-like. Everybody agreed on the right things and did the right things and so on. And it was very nice, but it didn't address the real problems, like the enormous inequality in society or the enormous problems with the environment. And now we have to face all these issues, including the inequality in society, including the fact that half the American population believes that they need a guy like Trump to protect their interests. I think they're wrong about it, but you have to accept the fact that there is a true problem here. And I think the same goes for Britain, the same goes for many European countries now, that the population is very unhappy, and that's what democracy is for. We have to address this. But I think mostly I've always had the idea that you shouldn't try to influence, for instance, politicians, or for that matter, politics. You should try to influence the population. Because the only thing that politicians listen to is the population, the voters. If the voters won't vote for them, that makes a difference. But if you try to please the politicians and show them this very interesting option, they will ignore you. The only thing they will not ignore is if the voters won't vote for them. And so forget about the politicians, forget about the men in power. I would even say forget about the business leaders, because the moment they understand that, for instance, the way agriculture is run today does not have a future, and there's therefore no money in it in the long run. There might be money in the next 5 years or 10 years, but in the long run, it's dead. Industry is dead in the long run as it's run today. But there's a lot of opportunity they can seek, but they have to change. So in a sense, I think it's more important to create this change and to create awareness of this change than to change the particular politicians or the particular business leaders. They'll be kicked out anyway. I don't find any satisfaction. I don't find a revolutionary satisfaction in killing the men and ladies in power. I think they'll just go obsolete. I think it's more interesting to make them obsolete than to necessarily to kill them. I have no personal aggression, but I think that there's a problem with them and we should kick them out of office.
Unite in a national effort to save from destruction.
Tor Nørretranders reminds us that wisdom comes not only from books and leaders, but from lived experience, from wonder, from community, and from the courage to face change. Whether we look to the past, to our local communities, or to the new possibilities of politics, our choices today shape the world we leave behind for the next generation. Hashtag find your role. Find your own role in this ongoing story about how we reinvent and change the world. If you've been inspired by this episode and you've seen a door opening maybe, use the inspiration to write a song about it, or a poem, or a theater play, or maybe that book you always thought that you were going to write. Or simply prompt AI to do something by giving it a surprising, unexpected twist in what you ask for.
There just could be a change in moral attitude from people worldwide, politicians worldwide, to see that self-interest is for the past, common interest is for the future.
So expect more Force of Life episodes on their way. And in the meantime, we'll be holding meetings in Zoom, online, teaming up with good people, changemakers, service to life custodians from all over the world, actually. And you can join us in that group of Zoom meeters if you send me an email on mick@forceoflife.earth. My name is Mick Eit. And you've been listening to the first episode of The Force of Life.
I hear you, Mother Earth, not in words, but in the silence beneath the trees. A heartbeat in the soil, a whisper carried by wind. The soil breathes, the trees remember. Tending the earth as she has tended us. We came from you, and to you we will return. Every breath we take is a gift. Every troubled rain is kindness of planet Earth. Return again to the land of fertility. Return again to what we once knew. It's how we listen, it's how we care. We are not separate, we are not above, we are the air, the bird's song, the trembling. To touch the ground, to touch the ground.